Blog Talk Radio.
From deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map, Blog Talk Radio and Wildlife Educational Services presents Larry Batson's Wild World. Discover the wonders of the natural world with nationally known wildlife educator Larry Batson as we visit his wild world.
From the remote and frigid jungles of Clinton Falls, Indiana, this is Larry Batson, and you're listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. Merry Christmas, everybody, as we, 2 days to go, it's hard to believe, and we're all in the holiday spirit, I hope, and looking forward to the visit of old St. Nick. Of course, manning the technical portion of our program in Ohio, Melissa Hovey and Wayne Larson, they keep us on the air on this magical network known as Blog Talk Radio. And of course, as always, in charge of the Wild World news from his massive broadcasting mecca in Indianapolis, Indiana, Dr. Henry Day. Good evening, Doctor.
Good evening, Mr. Batson.
How's well, are you in a holiday
Batson
spirit?
Wildlife Preserve?
Oh, it's great here at the Wildlife Preserve. Are you in a holiday spirit?
Yes, I am. I'm all excited.
Oh, it should be a fantastic. It looks like we're going to have a white Christmas.
That's what they're calling for.
Not
like we need the snow.
Yeah, I've already become sickened by the sight of snow. But, you know, what is one to do? Our guest tonight, man, it's a pleasure to have him back. Mark Madison with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We're going to be talking to him in just a few moments about a recent expedition he took to New Orleans to bring back the archives of Johnny Lynch, who basically, my understanding, was responsible for bringing the whooping crane back from the brink of extinction. And it's going to be exciting to talk to Mark and find out what's going on at the National Conservation Training Center. Of course, as always, underwriting the Wild World News, Jet Kaiser Film, using an artistic, modern style, they produce affordable wedding videos that are as unique as the wonderful couples that star in them. That's Jet Kaiser at jetkaiser.com, master cinematographer. Very creative. It's all HD. And if you're getting married in the future, you might want to check out his website. Dr. Day, what do you have for us tonight?
Well, before I start the news, I wanted to tell everybody I received your Christmas card with your lovely daughter viewing the Christmas tree on it.
Well, that's nice. I'm glad you did receive that.
And for those of you who don't know, his daughter is an olive baboon.
Yes, she is, and she's definitely looking forward to Christmas morning to see what gifts Santa Claus has brought her this year. I'll give you a little hint. It might be a Elmo in the works. We'll have to see. We tried to give her an Elmo a couple months ago because she does watch television. She does watch Sesame Street on the Sprout Channel. And she basically disemboweled the Elmo and ripped off its eyes. So I don't know how the Christmas gift's going to go, but there'll be a lot of entertainment Christmas morning regardless.
Yeah, well, I don't think I want her tickling me then.
Okay, Doctor.
All right. Well, there's nothing like getting a puppy for Christmas. Now, a Rhodesian Ridgeback gave birth to 17 puppies, and they all managed to survive. The puppies and their mother live in Neuen, Germany. The dog's owner, an animal psychiatrist, had to take some time off to care for the puppies, and she said this last Monday she's working on finding them new homes.
They may need a psychiatrist after that deal. Gosh, 17 puppies.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
I might have to go back and visit Mom.
Oh, my Lord.
All right, Ketchum, Idaho. U.S. Forest Service officials in central Idaho say skiers should stay away from elk to avoid stressing them out this winter. Julie Thomas of the Sawtooth National Forest says elk need their energy reserves to survive the winter. Now, the rangers have seen tracks from skiers trying to get close to the wintering elk.
Well, these skiers are very stupid because elk, they, oh, my Lord, you know, those are daggers they have on hanging off their heads, those antlers. I mean, Lord have mercy, that's just not smart. Skiers, stay away. If you're listening, stay away from the elk. Leave them alone.
That's right. Okay, we've got a bevy of bird news tonight. Now, all across the country, bird watchers and natural enthusiasts, nature enthusiasts, conducted the annual Christmas bird count, an all-day census of birds found in the area. Now, this goes on all across the country. Now, the Audubon's long-running wintertime tradition includes more than 2,000 counts throughout the Americas and beyond from December 14th through January the 5th. Now, it's the 111th year for this program, and it's the longest-running citizen science project in the nation. Now, to give you an idea of what they're doing, let's say here in Wichita, Kansas, for the second time since 1955, more than 100 species of birds were found in the state during the census. Now, in New York, 59 species were counted in Central Park. The bird watchers have counted some 6,000-plus birds and 59 species in the park there. And they've spotted some rare birds that usually aren't seen there in the park, such as the red-headed woodpecker. Now, the teams of bird watchers guided by park rangers spent the morning canvassing the park's 843 acres in Manhattan. Now, the tallies will help show how bird populations have changed in the last century.
I can't even imagine trying to count birds. And I can't even imagine there's that many species living in the middle of New York City. That's extraordinary.
Well, that is pretty cool.
Yes, it is. Wow. Well, that's good for them. Can you use your toes, too?
Yeah, if you need to.
Oh,
toes.
Okay.
Tillamook, Oregon. Wildlife officials are investigating a probable outbreak of canine distemper among raccoons along the north coast from Seaside to Astoria. The State Department of Fish and Wildlife said there has been numerous complaints in the recent weeks about sick and injured raccoons, and the canine distemper is a contagious viral disease.
That's a big problem. Wow. I hope they can get that. That's going to be tough. That'll be tough for them.
Yeah. Sioux Falls, South Dakota. State and federal wildlife agencies offered a $1,000 reward for information leading to a conviction in the shooting of a bald eagle. The adult bird was shot southwest of Ravinia in Charles Mix County sometime before December 18th. The eagle was taken to a veterinarian to repair a broken wing. And for all you people who don't know, bald eagles are protected under the federal and state laws.
They should string them up. Oh, wait a minute. The bird wasn't killed, was it?
No.
Give them life.
They should just break one of their wings.
Yes. That's,
yeah.
My Lord. How do you shoot an eagle accidentally? How could you ever mistake it for another type? At least I'm talking a bald eagle. Mistake it for another type of bird. What a bunch of morons.
I agree. All right, we're off to Brunswick, Georgia. State environment officials said they are extending the food shrimp harvest season by 10 days. They're extending it out to January the 10th. Surveys showed shrimp are hovering at or above normal levels of abundance. Pat Geer, chief of marine fisheries, says that they're considering the consumer demand for the fresh shrimp. The state also said a number of working trawlers rose slightly in 2010. So the shrimp population is doing so good, they've got more fishermen out there.
Well, that's extraordinary. Wow, that's good news. Good news for the local economy. Their local economy.
All right, now we're going to touch on one of your favorite things.
Uh-oh.
Augusta, Georgia. Decades of monitoring and 8 seasons of tightly controlled recreational hunting have brought the state's once imperiled alligator population to a substantial balance. Now, the alligator population is estimated at around 222,000, which should remain fairly constant and still allow for the limited quota hunts.
How many do they have?
Well, 222,000.
Well, that's a couple more than I have.
That is a couple more than you have. But
yes,
you've still got a pretty good collection out there.
Yes, I probably have the largest collection in Clinton Falls, Indiana.
I would say so. Now, Baxter, your educator.
Yes.
How big is he now? How much does he weigh?
Oh, he weighs, I don't know how much he weighs. He's about eight and a half feet long. And I've had him since he was about a foot long. Had him.
And he's retired from the school shows now, isn't he?
Oh, yes. He would eat the children. That's the problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's retired from the school programs. Though not retired from occasional alligator wrestling, though.
Which I'm sure you enjoy.
I do enjoy that.
All right, now listen to this story. Glen Burnie, Maryland. Natural Resources police officials are defending the agency's finding of two men who helped rescue a deer in the frozen Patapsco River. Now, the men were fined $90 because they didn't have life preservers or flotation devices aboard the boat when they helped the deer. Now, the men plan to fight the citations.
I would fight that. Gosh, what law enforcement? My gosh. I can see both points, but please, give the guys a break. They were doing something they thought was good.
Well, that's right. I think they probably learned their lesson.
They probably
won't
thought,
do it again.
Well, they did, but, you know, oh, if there's a deer in a lake, it's going to drown. Oh, let's check for our flotation devices first. Gosh.
Right. All right, while we're on the deer, Lashmet, West Virginia. Hunter Roger Mills, 61, got a surprise when he shot a four-point deer. The deer had antlers, but he was a she. Mills took his catch to a wildlife checking station in Spanishburg, and the personnel said they had never seen a doe with horns. Now, Tom Dowdy, a wildlife biologist, says it can happen, but it's very rare.
Well, it was a transvestite deer.
They should have known by the fishnet pantyhose.
That's right. Well, you know, another funny story. I had a friend who had a Barbary sheep escape. This was many, many years ago. They're similar to the bighorn, but very similar to the bighorn. They got the big horns, and they go back across, you know what they look like, or have
yep.
a good idea. Well, during deer hunting season, somebody shot that thing, and they took it to a deer check station. Now, what worries me is that person goes into the woods with loaded firearms.
Right.
Oh, well, that's funny. All right, Henry.
All right, well, we're going to end up tonight with the trumpeter swans. Now, the trumpeter swans are making their migration stopovers this winter in Blue Springs, Missouri. Four rare trumpeter swans were spotted at Lake Remembrance. Now, Larry Rizzo, a natural history biologist for the Department of Conservation, said he has been getting more reports of trumpeter swans in the state. Now, the trumpeters are the largest waterfowl in North America with a wingspan of up to 8 feet.
Truly magnificent birds. I've seen them in Yellowstone National Park. And yes, very nice. So
well, that's the animal news for tonight. And always remember, a duck's quack doesn't echo.
That's right. That's Dr. Henry Day with the Wild World News. Underwritten by Jet Kaiser Films, we want to tell everyone our entire program is underwritten by several folks, such as Jerry Jones and Tire Service Plus. They keep the animal truck on the road so we can travel these thousands of miles doing our school lectures with our collection of wild animals. Also, Peter and Kathy Weimer, We Want You Cottages, way up in Chautauqua Lake in western New York. They have a very exciting new website called iKids Fishing, where youngsters can download that photo of that big fish they caught over the summer and compare it to young anglers all across North America. The website, www.wewantyou.com. Also, McGregor Mountain Lodge in beautiful, scenic Estes Park, Colorado, God's country. info@McGregorMountainLodge.com. Don't be afraid to go to there in the winter, folks. It's absolutely beautiful. You'll have the park to yourself, and that's the place to stay, McGregor Mountain Lodge. Also, Harrison College, very exciting new vet tech courses that they offer. So you can help out the vets if you're into that sort of thing, working with animals. It's www.harrison.edu or their toll-free number, 1-888-544-4422. In Santee Cooper Country, beautiful South Carolina, Lake Marion, Lake Moultrie, known as Santee Cooper Lakes. They cover 171,000 acres and 450 miles of shoreline, known for world-class fishing. Here's that number, 1-800-227-8510, or their website, www.santeecoopercountry.org. Give them a call. They'll plan your whole trip. And those are the underwriters. And also, LarryTheAnimalGuy.com. We have a brand new book, Alphabet Swamp, available there. It's a little bit too late to ship those out for Christmas this year, but after Christmas, hey, if you've got a youngster, nephew, niece, cousin, whatever, we'll ship it out and have it autographed to them. And also a very special thank you to Radio Mom, our brand new underwriter, and they're very exciting Radio Mom shop where you can find great deals, and that's at www.radiomom.fm. Joining us tonight, old friend from the National Conservation Training Center. He is a historian for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and recently took a trip down to New Orleans to bring back the archives of a gentleman named Johnny Lynch, who basically brought the whooping crane back from extinction, is my understanding. And from his vacation villa in Boston, Massachusetts, joining us tonight, Mark Madison. Good evening, Mark.
Evening, Larry. It's good talking to you again.
Well, it's great talking to you. Merry Christmas to you and your family. I hope I asked you at the beginning, are you there on holiday? And he said, absolutely. So that's fantastic.
Catch me before the eggnog gets me.
Oh, you can drink the eggnog. Dr. Day does that on a regular basis, so it doesn't really matter much.
Right.
Some of us have affected that.
It won't affect the quality of the show, believe me. How's the weather in Boston?
We have a dusting of snow, and it's really, really cold. It's about 15 degrees with gusty winds. So, I left tropical West Virginia for this.
I know better than that. What's it, 20 degrees in West Virginia?
I know. It's freezing down there, too.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, the whole deer problem kind of scares me. We can't tell the bucks from the does. That's ominous. We already got the intersex fish in the Potomac. This is the next stage, I think, up there.
Well, had the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service been aware of this particular incident?
I had not heard of it till Dr. Day brought it up, but it is kind of funny because we have been researching, you know, that epidemic of intersex fish in the Potomac from basically synthetic hormones being dumped in wastewater.
Mm-hmm.
And so it causes the fish to have both male and female organs. It's a big issue. It's affecting reproduction. It's affecting recreational fishing. So that's been a huge issue, and West Virginia has been one of the hardest hit states for that. And now we find out the whitetails are screwed up too. What's next?
What's created that problem? Or is it just a weird freak of nature?
Yeah, this sounds like it's just a fluke. And then the other thing Dr. Day mentioned was the bald eagle.
Mm-hmm.
West Virginia has a huge poaching issue with bald eagles. It's just extraordinary. I don't know why people are shooting them. I think it's to sell them in parts of West Virginia, but it's been a huge issue. We've been working with the West Virginia DNR trying to help stop some of that. But it's a big problem. You know, you mentioned, well, how could you mistake a bald eagle? We've had people shoot trumpeter swans and whooping cranes, which really don't look like any other bird.
No.
Think about it. We have a whole series of posters we've made, you know, don't shoot this. This is a trumpeter swan. Don't shoot this. It's a whooping crane. And still we have people accidentally shoot them. So it's kind of mind-boggling.
It's kind of like our own sort of terrorism against the wild world. I mean, what goes on?
Well, if they can't tell a whooping crane from a game bird, I definitely don't want these folks out doing the Christmas bird count.
Lord have mercy, no. And what worries me is they're in the forest with firearms. You know, one of the scariest things.
Go ahead. They can't see anything.
Well, you know, one of the scariest things I ever saw, we were at the Cabela's in West Virginia, and whenever we come to the National Conservation Training Center, it's on our path, and we usually stop on the way back. And we pick up a little something, you know. But I pulled up there the last time, and I see this guy, and no offense to people that are obese, but this guy was obese. I mean, he was huge. And he's carrying a crossbow that he just bought. Now I thought to myself, if he's actually using that to hunt with, and if he wounds a deer, there is no way that he's going to track that deer down to kill it. It's not going to happen. I'm thinking, Lord, have mercy.
I have to say, we were in Cabela's about 6 hours ago. The Cabela's in Pennsylvania is on our route, or we're making on our route from West Virginia to Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And they have, it was the same at the West Virginia one, they have one of the most impressive dioramas I've ever seen of North American wildlife, and it's just amazing. They have a record black bear shot in Pennsylvania on display, and you can see pronghorns and polar bears. It's just, it puts our little archive to shame. Got a tiger and a couple other things in there.
Oh, yeah, it is quite impressive. I need to hit them up now to be an underwriter, being we've already given them like a... But, yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing.
I spent enough there on fly fishing supplies. They ought to be able to underwrite you.
Well, they should. You are quite the fly fisherman. I can even remember that you go fishing on your lunch hours there at the National Conservation Training Center.
Yes, I do. It's the only thing that keeps me sane. That's part of my day.
Well,
should we talk about Johnny Lynch? You alluded to him earlier in the show.
Well, we are. We want to, absolutely. In fact, I know that you and Jeannie Harold went down to Louisiana and to bring back the archives of the late Johnny Lynch. Is my understanding correct that he was basically brought the whooping crane back from the brink of extinction?
Yeah, Johnny is the type of wildlife biologist from the 30s to the 50s you just don't see anymore. Not only was he a wildlife biologist, he was a pilot, too. Called a pilot biologist, which meant he would do bird counts basically with a steno pad in his lap as he flew low.
Whoa.
You know, to count ducks and so on, really low. And he was from Louisiana, which made him even crazier. He was from Cajun country. He actually lived in Lafayette. And he was interesting for a number of things. He was a crazy pilot. Anybody who flew with him invariably commented how low and fast he flew, usually at the same time. Always extraordinary. And he hated to write memos. Which is kind of unique for a bureaucrat. And one of my favorite things he ever wrote was he was told to write about how to bring waterfowl back in the U.S. And he wrote, instead of writing a memo, he wrote kind of like a little play or a skit called Escape from Mediocrity, which kind of resonates with a lot of the stuff we do these days. It was five biologists basically talking over beer in a bar. The best way to bring back ducks. And yet it's brilliant. He was absolutely right. He was advocating to protect the prairie pothole region in the Great Plains, these little ponds that oftentimes fill up in the spring and then dry up by the summer, where ducks breed and feed, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So he's really a smart avian biologist, but a slightly off-key one. And whooping crane numbers by the 40s had been decimated. Primarily from hunting, of all things. And then in the 50s, DDT just about finished them off for good by thinning their eggshells. And they tried to hatch them, they'd crack. Same thing happened to eagles, peregrine falcons, a number of larger birds really suffered DDT. And Johnny was convinced that there were whooping cranes still left in Louisiana. Even though everybody said, there's no whooping cranes in Louisiana. And he said, I've seen him. And if you go back to Lafayette and that part of Louisiana, it's still hard to access some of those bayous. They flood, and the road system wasn't as good in the 50s as it is today. And he flew out there, and doggone if he didn't find some of the last whooping cranes, chased them on foot captured them,
wow.
reared them for a while in his house, something we wouldn't really do today legally, and then
right.
eventually gave them to the Audubon Zoo there in New Orleans, which is a marvelous zoo.
Yes, it is.
And they became, you know, one of the places that's working to restore them along with the Tuxen. And the most amazing thing happened just a couple weeks ago. It looks like they're going to try to restore a flock of whooping cranes to Louisiana because they realize now that's part of their native territory. And Johnny was really the guy pushing that, you know, hoopers used to be in Louisiana. There's still a few there. They ought to be brought back. And his daughter, Mary, has been campaigning for this for years, and it looks like working with the Audubon Zoo, they're going to bring back a flock of hoopers, which would be amazing. There's really only three flocks out there, one that goes to Texas, one that goes to Florida, and this would be the third one. And it'd be a real nice memorial to John. It'd just feel good.
So how many do they estimate exist in the wild? Do they know?
Boy, we don't have a lot in the wild. We have what we consider a sustainable flock that goes down to Texas, Aransas. And then we have a smaller flock that flies from southern Wisconsin to Florida. And then this would be a third one in Louisiana. And, you know, one of the things about the hoopers is because their numbers became so low in the wild, you had to captively breed them. And I know you know all about that.
Mm-hmm.
But when you do that, if you think about a whooping crane, which basically migrates across North America, like my parents go
yeah.
from Wisconsin from down to, you know, Laughlin or something. Well, that's what these birds do, too. They're smart. Wisconsin's not a fun place to be in winter. There's, you know, 110
nope.
inches of snow
pretty
yep. below.
Yep.
So when you captively breed them, not only do you have to teach them how to feed, how to fly, how to do all the basic things birds have to, but then you have to teach them their migratory route. You know, and that's where you see those glider planes that kind of like whooping cranes. They got kind of white wings and so on. But amazingly, you take them on the migratory route back and forth, and they can find their way back and forth. I think if I flew behind an airplane once to Florida and back to Wisconsin, I doubt if I could do that again on my own. Pretty sure I couldn't. In fact, I got lost driving back to Boston, where I've driven, you know, 100 times before. But these birds have amazing migratory ability. Just, you know, it kind of blows my mind. Bird brain is a really unfair stereotype that we should never
yeah.
use.
Well, it is amazing the amount of work, not only by Mr. Lynch, but other individuals, to make this all happen. I mean,
it
that's
really
extraordinary.
Well, you know, that's a really good point, Larry. You know, I know you work with endangered species a great deal, and you do education. And I think one of the things that you conveyed and that we try to get across is, you know, there's some species that we talked about, some of those with Dr. Day, that if you just stop poisoning them or overhunting them, they really rebound like crazy, like white-tailed deer. I saw at Cabela's. They said, you know, maybe there were 200,000 white-tailed deer at their lowest number around the turn of the century. Now there's 20 million white-tailed deer. So
yeah.
here's something you'll hunt to death and they'll come back like crazy. I can think of other species, some of the duck species and so on have come back robustly. Canada geese is a good example. And then there's other species like whooping cranes, California condors, red wolves that are really slow breeding that you actually take out of the wild almost all the population. Breed up in zoos, have to develop all these new techniques, you know, to bring them back. Everything from whooping crane costumes to ultralight gliders to teach them their migratory routes, special pens so they'll get acclimated to people. And they come back very slowly, and they might never recover completely. And I think it's hard for the public to understand, you know, well, how come you took bald eagles off the endangered species list, but you can't get whooping cranes off? And it's really, you know, they have a different type of lifestyle, a different type of natural. And that makes it very hard to bring them back.
Well, you're right. And another good example is the American alligator. I mean, in the 50s, they were just about gone.
Yeah, look how they've come back. Well,
oh, yeah, I think they say there's a million in Florida alone. I mean, every drainage ditch and puddle has an alligator living in it.
I know. Yeah, there's some of these species. You really ought to have two categories of endangered species. You should have the robust ones that can do okay with the way we've transformed the natural world and live okay with people and come back robustly. There's probably more white-tailed deer now than ever existed in North America. And then there's these other species that, for whatever reason, they don't do well with humans. And I think whooping cranes are a good example. Their migratory route is so long. Think about going from Wisconsin to Florida. That if the habitat is transformed, like in Illinois, where there's very little natural habitat left, they can't make that route anymore. So you got a gigantic, you know, route, like the whole of I-81 or I-95. And if you pull out a chunk, they've had it. They can't survive getting back and forth. So that lifestyle has really made it hard to bring them back. Wolves need a very big territory. While the red wolf is found in the southeastern U.S., there's no big natural area like Yellowstone does put them back into. And then California condor, they're a species that adapted to eating carrion like woolly mammoths. Then they adapted to eating bison. The carrion that they traditionally eat doesn't exist anymore. And, you know, Southern California is a heck of a place to come back as an endangered species. You know, so some of these species just don't do well with people, and it's very hard to bring them back.
It's a big job for everybody. Mark Madison is our guest of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We're going to take a quick break, Mark, so if you have to go to the little boys' room, here's your opportunity. We've got a few PSAs. Or regret that eggnog. You know, fill that eggnog back up.
I'll be sure to listen to the sponsors while I do that, though.
All right, sure. This is Larry Batson, and you're listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. We'll be right back.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio.
Take me fishing and show me how to drive the boat.
Take me fishing so I can tell you what a great dad you've been.
Take someone you love out on the water and see where the water takes you.
Take me fishing because I miss my boy.
Rediscover the joy of boating and fishing. Get information and get going at takemefishing.org.
We're Rascal Flats. There's a place where ordinary people do extraordinary things every day. That place is called the American Red Cross. When you help the American Red Cross, you help America. Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org to learn more.
Welcome back to Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio. Once again, here's your host, Larry Batson.
This is Larry Batson. You are listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on this marvelous network known as Blog Talk Radio. Merry Christmas, everybody. I hope you have an opportunity to really enjoy your holiday. God bless your family and all your friends. And it's great Christmas time, man. Just love it. I want to remind everybody that next week on the program, got a very exciting guest, Laura Cheadle, brand-new artist from the New York and New Jersey area. Very exciting. She's a funky singer. She's got a fantastic CD, and we'll be playing some cuts from her CD and also have the opportunity to talk to her. But it's pretty good music, isn't it, Dr. Day?
Oh, it's wonderful. She has a beautiful voice.
Yes, she did. And she's going to join us next week right here on Larry Batson's Wild World. We'd like to thank all of our underwriters that keep us on the air, make it possible for us to bring these wonderful guests and broadcast around the world, such as Jerry Jones and Tire Service Plus. We Want You Cottages at Chautauqua Lake up in New York, McGregor Mountain Lodge in Estes Park, Colorado, Harrison College, exciting new vet tech school at www.harrison.edu, Santee Cooper Country in beautiful South Carolina, you like to go fishing, you ever been fishing in South Carolina before, Mark?
I'm sorry, what?
Have you ever been fishing in South Carolina?
No, I was just down there, though, and it looked like they had amazing fishing down there. I wish I just forgot to bring my rod and reel.
Well, I'll tell you what, the Santee Cooper Lakes, Lake Marion, Lake Moultrie, now they're pretty good size. They cover 171,000 acres and 450 miles of shoreline. I'll bet you catch one of those big blue cats on a fly rod. That'll be a whole different deal.
Next time I go down, I'm bringing my rod. I was down there visiting some refuges. We have a big sandhill crane refuge down there.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw a beautiful fishing area. I could have shot myself for not bringing my rod and reel.
Oh, wow. Well, it is absolutely fantastic. And also, we want to remind everyone about my website, LarryTheAnimalGuy.com, and also a big thank you to RadioMom.fm. And they do lots of great stuff for Larry Bathen's Wild World, and we really appreciate the work that they do. Our guest this week is Mark Madison with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He's a historian. What exactly does a historian do for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Mark?
Well, that's kind of a personal question, Larry. I don't know.
Well, it is.
If I want to answer. No, I work with Jeannie Harold, who you mentioned earlier,
mm-hmm.
to maintain an archive out there. Jeannie basically takes care of everything, and I do some interpretation and teaching from it. And then I do two other fairly interesting things that one just occurred and one's coming up next month, and that is we occasionally organize historical conferences.
Mm-hmm.
And we are celebrating this year, in fact, this month, the 50th anniversary of Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which is a really interesting place. It's been in the news a lot for its oil reserves, and then a big debate about whether to drill them or not. But it is it's an amazing refuge. It's the biggest refuge in the world. It's 19.3 million acres, which coincidentally is the size of South Carolina.
Whoa!
So there's a wildlife refuge that's as big as the whole state of South Carolina. And it's even bigger than that, really, because it has a sister refuge on the Canadian side of the border up there. It's in the northeast corner of Alaska. And it's got three extraordinary species up there, very charismatic species. One is polar bears, and the polar bears were doing really, really well up there, coming back until global warming has caused some problems with their ice thickness and their ability to hunt and store up enough food. And then there's obviously a caribou herd, a porcupine caribou herd, that starts in Canada and then migrates to the shore of Arctic Refuge, which is their calving grounds, and then goes back to Canada. It makes an amazing journey, one of the most difficult journeys anywhere, and probably the hardest part of its journey isn't the terrain, isn't the mountain, it's actually the mosquitoes. The mosquitoes are so bad up there that occasionally the caribou will drown trying to get the mosquitoes off them, fall off cliffs, and so on. So it's just horrible mosquito territory. And then the third species up there is really interesting. It's a musk oxen. And it goes back to what we were talking about before with the whooping crane. Musk oxen, very old species, been around a long time. And it was hunted to extinction about 1900, initially by Russians and later Americans up in Alaska. It's the way musk oxen defend against wolves is very effective for wolves, but very ineffective against hunters. They might have seen pictures or seen them in action. They make a circle,
mm-hmm.
and they kind of use their horns to drive the wolves off. Well, if you were hunting them, the musk oxen conveniently gather themselves into a circle and then stand there while you shoot them. So they were pretty much extirpated from all of Alaska. And then in the 1950s, a few small herds were brought back, and they're doing really well in the Arctic Refuge. It's kind of a neat place, and that not only is it a huge ecosystem that, you know, rightfully has been described as something that's preserved,
mm-hmm.
but it actually has been improved, became a refuge site.
Well, that's fantastic.
For this symposium, we're having President Carter come out because he expanded the refuge in 1980, pretty much doubled its size. We've got a bunch of, we've got all the former refuge managers who've been up there since it was founded in 1960. We have George Schaller, who originally was a gorilla expert and then a snow leopard expert, but he went up there to lobby for it in 1956. And it's just going to be a really fun celebration of a pretty unique place. We've got a play, we've got a couple movie premieres going on, and it should be a really fun historical conference. So we put those on also, and that's kind of a fun part of my job.
And that'll all be happening at the National Conservation Training Center.
Yep, it's going to happen this January 18th through the 20th, and we're hoping to put some information up in early January. We're going to try and have the whole thing on streaming video, so people can hear George Schaller and President Carter and some of the scientists and so on talking about Arctic Refuge. We want to share it with as many people.
Well, as soon as that's all arranged or figured out, please let us know, and we'll help promote it on this little broadcast.
That would be great, Larry.
So our listeners,
maybe the home ground of Sasquatch too. We're not sure.
Well, you never know. You know,
19.3 million acres. He could be up there.
There's a lot of places for him to hang out. There's a lot of places to make little Sasquatches and not be bothered.
And then one other thing I do that might be interesting to the listeners, being as it's holiday season and people are taking time off and maybe renting movies or relaxing with family, is I run an environmental film festival.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had something called the American Conservation Film Festival for 8 years at NCT. It's gotten pretty big. We get about, 10,000 people come to it, and we show about 40 original films. And we had some really good films this year that people might want to check out on Netflix or Blockbuster, Redbox, just for an interesting holiday film. You might be familiar with some of these too, but it seems like a good season to talk about good environmental documentaries.
Well, what are some of the documentaries available? So, is there a list on the web or?
There is. If you go to conservationfilm.org,
mm-hmm.
which is a pretty simplistic website, you can see all the films we showed, and there were a couple that were really unique and interesting. One that we showed, I really enjoyed, and I think you would enjoy this, Larry, since you were talking about water earlier.
Yeah.
It was a film called Green, and it was about it followed an orangutan in Indonesia, and there was no narration to it. It was made by a French filmmaker, so I guess even if it was narrated, I wouldn't have understood it.
Right.
But it's just a very, very thoughtful, moving story about this orangutan as it got kind of forced out of its jungle habitat through overlogging, then was taken into a veterinary hospital and kind of got depressed. But it was an amazing film, told almost entirely through the primate's eyes, basically, in motion. That actually won our best film award this year. And that was really fun. And then we had another film that actually came out late last year called The Cove. Have you heard about that one, Larry?
No, I haven't.
That is a neat film. You remember the TV show Flipper about the dolphin?
Yeah.
Well, it starts out with Flipper's trainer, a guy named Rick Ocasek. Which was interesting, how Flipper was trained and how the show became so popular, and Flipper kind of had his own little lagoon in Florida, and his trainer had a mansion, and Flipper apparently near the end of the TV series became pretty depressed for various reasons and drowned himself. of all things. You know, dolphins are mammals, and they can actually hold themselves underwater and drown themselves. So his trainer felt bad about this. Missed the signs of press. He kind of wished he'd found other dolphins for him to be with or done something to make his life more pleasant. So he began looking for other causes to fight for. And he stumbled upon this dolphin slaughter in Japan that occurs in this fairly isolated cove. It was fairly well known, and a huge number of dolphins are slaughtered in this cove for, I guess, the sushi industry or something. But nobody could ever film it because the town was very protective of the cove, and they knew it would be very bad publicity. So they set to gather this kind of commando team, people with weird mercenary backgrounds and expert in surveillance cameras and expert in hiding microphones. They have cameras that pop out of rocks. It was kind of a combination of, you know, Mission Impossible meets an environmental film, and, mm-hmm. you know, eventually find out what's going on in this code. Pretty horrific. And their efforts to stop it. Because the cast of characters, from Flipper's trainer, to these technical geeks, to these kind of, you know, spy guys, were so odd, it made it kind of engaging. And it was very, but that was a very big film called The Cove. And then we had another film that was hilarious from Britain that was called Beyond the Pole.
Uh-huh.
Larry, I don't know. Did you ever see the film Spinal Tap?
Oh, yes. Yeah, more than one.
This was an environmental version of Spinal Tap. It was a fake documentary. It was so well done. The person I went to see it with, she thought till the very end that it was a real documentary. So you know, it had this realistic presentation, and it's two British young men who decide they're going to save the environment by skiing to the North Pole, carrying all their own supplies. They're going to be the first ones to make it up to the North Pole carrying their own supplies on their back. And they're woefully under-equipped intellectually and physically for this. And, of course, things start to go wrong. They're quickly being pursued by, I think it's a Norwegian team, who's skiing more effectively and faster than them. One of their guides has been on numerous polar expeditions, and he warns them about the dangers of getting too close to the polar bears that they revere so much, and this leads to bad consequences. And basically, a series of accidents occur as these two young boobs basically try to make it to the pole. And it's called Beyond the Pole. And what's so amusing about it is I'm the selection chair for the film festival, so I get mailed about 200 films, 200 DVDs.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just pop them in and watch them at home on my computer or on the DVD player. And this one looked like a real documentary, like two men save the world going to the North Pole. The same thing happened to me for the first 15 minutes. I thought I was watching a real documentary. It pulls you in, and gradually you realize it's like Spinal Tap. And the points it makes, you know, were very good. And it was a different type of film that I hadn't seen. That was...
So are you like a record producer that gets a kabillion CDs in this day and age? They listen to 20 seconds and they know whether it's a hit or a miss.
You know, I have to admit, that does happen. You know, you get 200 DVDs, and after 8 years, you start to look for something different. You know, I've seen a lot of environmental documentaries, like, and you know, the three I mentioned, or the couple I mentioned, Green, The Cove, and Beyond the Pole, were pretty different. You know, one because there was no narration, the other because it was such an odd group of adventures, and the third one because it was actually a spoof. When you start to look for different is you get kind of jaded. I've seen a lot of the PBS documentaries on the wolves of Yellowstone, and those are very good.
Yeah.
But you look at something new, and if it doesn't grip you in the first 15 minutes, that might be it.
Yeah, I was wondering that, because I can't see Mark Madison watching 200 complete films.
No,
so you
I try to watch all of them, or at least part of all of them.
Right.
We have a selection of 9 people. Now, some of them really jump out at you, and others less so. And one of the fun things we've done is we started a student film competition for university and high school. And, boy, with the technology today, these kids are doing amazing films, editing films. You know, if you've been to NCTC, we have these giant film editing suites with all these computers.
Yes.
A whole room dedicated to. They're editing films just on, you know, Dell laptops.
Wow.
That looks like we made, you know, a couple of years ago, and the technology has just opened up. They can shoot digitally, you know, on an inexpensive camera. They can edit themselves, and some of these kids have made amazing films. That's some really joy for us. We had a wonderful film. We gave the student film award to a student from New Zealand who did a great film on albatross.
Wow.
Fascinating bird.
Yeah.
And almost no on land.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the luck to go to a albatross colony when I was in New Zealand. And, you know, it's one of the few places you ever see them on land. They're at sea almost 99% of their life. But they come here to breed and mate and all that. And he did a thing on albatrosses. But the closest to them was...
Well, I know the students that came in for the SC3 conference in June, they did some pretty amazing little film things and are pretty short order. So these
Right. You know, we're in the middle of organizing that again, and you'll probably be getting a call.
Oh, I love it.
But I have to tell you.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. Larry. I was just going to tell you, it's become... even since last year, it's become one of the main things we're trying to do in not only Fish and Wildlife Service, but the whole Department of Interior. And I think this ties into a lot of what you and Cheryl do, is we're looking for new ways to attract young people to careers in natural resources. You know, and one way to do it is, like you and Cheryl do, introduce them into how fulfilling a life can be working with wildlife. And we do a lot to explain what the wildlife do and what their habits are and so on. But I think more than that, you and Cheryl really enjoy what you're doing. And that comes out in you know, your presentations. We're trying to do that too. We're trying to, you know, through SC3, bring people like you or maybe biologists in the field or oceanographers or whoever out there to, you know, show people being a conservationist can be a really interesting profession. And not everybody has to grow up to be an investment banker or an attorney or a doctor. There's a lot of fulfillment in the natural resources, too.
Well, I've expressed that on this program several times, that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is very concerned because now kids are so attuned to being indoors with the computers and the computer games, and they need to go out and get muddy and wet and look for spiders and snakes and whatever.
It's a huge issue. I mean, how do we get them to go places where there aren't electrical outlets, basically, or where there's no BlackBerry reception? And, you know, it's challenging, but I think there are ways to do it. I mean, I look at these student filmmakers. They obviously are getting something out of their encounters with nature, and I think, you know, I think our task is to find ways to reach these folks, maybe new ways, you know, digital photography, whatever they're into. Geocaching, there's a whole bunch of ways to bring young people into nature, but we have to do a better job of making, you know, wildlife work seem like one of the most exciting career paths. Like, you and I know that's true.
Oh, well, it's absolutely is true.
We've got to convey it to them.
There's nothing more exciting. I've expressed that several times. I have youngsters that say, I want to do your job. I said, well, work with animals. You know, there's several things you can do. Go to college and become a zoologist or biologist you know, and the world is at your beckon. I mean,
it's true, and you know, that's one of the interesting things about the filmmakers. It's, you know, lots of times you think, well, if I want to work with wildlife, all I could, you know, I would have to be a wildlife biologist. That's not true. I mean, I'm a historian, but I work for the Fish and Wildlife Service. The filmmakers work for the Fish and Wildlife Service. You probably met Bob Pyle when you were
right.
at C3. He's a writer, but he has lots of wonderful experiences with nature and wildlife. There's there's so many different occupations that can involve wildlife and make your life more fulfilling. But you have to at least consider that option.
Well, I know with the SC3, there's probably several of those youngsters that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service probably have recruited. They just don't know it yet. Down the road, they're going to decide to. It's kind of like recruiting basketball or football players, and it's because there were some very talented young people there.
It's our most important crop, and I guess we should explain to the listeners that SC3 stands for Student Conservation and Climate Conference.
Right.
We've held two of them. We were fortunate enough to have Larry come down at the last one and give a fun outdoor talk to the students about Bigfoot, which they really enjoyed a lot. And the purpose is to introduce high school students to the conservation field in the hopes that they'll work in it at some future day, and we're going to do it again this year, the 4th of July weekend, July of 2011, and we keep on doing this every year. It's been very successful so far.
Well, I really want to be a part of it. I'm going to put in my sales pitch. I really would love to come to NCTC in the month of July and frighten those children around that campfire again.
That would be... Tape and everything, but even more than that, you and Cheryl work so much with young people. I mean, you really do this, and I think it's something we forget. You know, we started out the program talking about, you know, bringing back whooping cranes and bald eagles. That's a numbers game, but it's also numbers of people that, you know, create a conservation constituency, folks that actually care about the environment, for its parks and refuges and forests. And we need to work on that crop, too. If we neglect the human end, we could lose all this just through indifference. It's really a concern. I mean, you mentioned it earlier. Richard Lude wrote that book on nature deficit disorder. That's really the concern. People will just become indifferent to it and fade away.
Yes, we have to.
Not indifferent.
Oh, that's right. We have to keep up the efforts and... Every day I wake up, I think, what more can we do to get these young people interested in the natural world? So that's my main goal in life. And I have all my friends here, these animal friends, to help me do that. And I think they do a pretty darn good job. I don't say so myself.
I tell you the one thing you do, and I hear that in Dr. Day's report and you and Cheryl, you share that passion for wildlife. You care enough to help aid wildlife, to talk about it, to take it around the country, which is not easy.
No.
to do a radio show on it, that is a passion. You know, just some people are passionate about art, Civil War, recreations, whatever.
Yep.
They have that passion. And I think that rubs off on young people. They're moved by people.
Well, I certainly hope so. Mark, it has been an absolute pleasure. I am so glad to have you on the show. I know that we kind of took you away from your Christmas festivities and with your family up there in Boston. God bless you for coming on. We love the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and everything they stand for. And of course, the National Conservation Training Center in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. I've kind of almost considered my second home and my second family over there. It's truly a joy.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Well, thanks for coming. We'll have to talk to you after the big conference next month at the NCTC. Yeah, I'll find out what went on and rubbing shoulders with Jimmy Carter, and that's just absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much, Mark, for being on this week.
Thank you, Larry.
And happy holidays to you and your family. We'd also like to thank Melissa Hovey and Wayne Larson, as always, doing a masterful job keeping us on the air and manning the controls. And Merry Christmas, Dr. Henry Day.
Merry Christmas.
What a great year to, well, I was going to say a great way to finish out the year, but we still have one more week left in old 2010. And next week on the show will be fantastic singer Lord Cheadle, and we'll be hearing some of her songs and talking to her about her career. And it's really looking forward to next year's show, or next week's show, I should say. And also a big thank you once again to Mark Madison with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. This is Larry Batson. Folks, you have been listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. Good night, everybody.
Thanks for listening this week to Larry Batson's Wild World. Be sure to join us again next week at 10 p.m. for more of the latest outdoor and wildlife news and information, along with great tales from your host, world-renowned wildlife expert, Mr. Larry Batson. Tune in again next week for another exciting edition of Larry Batson's Wild World. Larry Batson's Wild World is a Batson Wildlife Educational Services production in association with Blog Talk Radio.